KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's second forum hour, we talk about wine, restaurants, and the great local chefs and winemakers of Northern California with San Francisco wine expert and critic at large, Robert Finnegan. He'll join us right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's program. Robert Finnegan is a San Francisco-based wine expert and wine and food critic who ran the Robert Finnegan Wine Newsletter for nearly a couple of decades. And actually, we haven't seen each other in that long, but he is, as the Chronicle has pointed out, a raconteur, a bon vivant, and has been at this for many, many years, going back to, I think, the time when he put an ad in for in the classified when he was at Harvard for people to come and cook meals for him, and they did. In fact, some Radcliffe ladies came. It's all in his new book, Corks and Forks. He's the author of a number of books, Which Wine?, Robert Finnegan's Essentials of Wine, Passport to San Francisco, and Robert Finnegan's Guide to Discriminating Dining in San Francisco, as well as Corks and Forks, the newest, subtitled 30 Years of Wine and Food, and his work has appeared in Wine and Spirits, Travel and Leisure, Food and Wine. And he joins us. And Bob Finnegan, good to see you again. Been much too long.
It has, Michael. It's great to be here.
I think I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about your history as a critic, because you go there are a lot of veterans around here who remember the name Jack Shelton, and that was really what launched you in many ways, was Jack Shelton.
Oh, no question about it. And I moved here from the East Coast right after school in 1967, and I'd already developed a pretty solid interest in food and wine by that time, and not knowing the San Francisco restaurant scene, I subscribed to Jack Shelton's Guide to Restaurants, which was a monthly newsletter. And I thought after a while, as I was learning more and more about California wines and as they were proliferating, that there should be a guide comparable to his, but about wine. And so I called him just out of the blue, just as a subscriber, and we had lunch, and he thought it was a great idea. But he said he couldn't really help me with it because he was in the process of selling the restaurant guide, and the putative buyers were interested in starting a wine guide. So I thought, light bulb went on, why not put together a small group of investors and be the successful bidder for the restaurant guide and write it myself? And that's what happened.
The rest is history. You did indeed, and became quite famous locally as a wine and celebrated restaurant critic. Talk about those two things. Maybe just kind of hone in on them. First of all, I mean, you in this book, which is somewhat of a memoir, you remind us of the old days, those of us who go back to those old days of Ernie's and, you know, the restaurants that were hallmark signature restaurants in San Francisco. When you think about how things have changed in terms of dining in this city or
yes,
just in the Bay Area, what comes to mind particularly right off the top?
Well, I would say a couple of things, Michael, at least a couple of things. One, the expansion of ethnic diversity and also the role of neighborhoods as important centers for interesting dining. It isn't all downtown or in Pacific Heights anymore, as we all know.
It's all over.
It's all over.
Yeah. And with respect to wines, I mean, in your book, you give us a whole, some minor treatises on wines, on Burgundy and Champagne and wine tasting in London and all wine tasting in Paris. But you've always been associated in many ways with and an expert on California wines. Are they still as exciting, still as worthy in the international market?
Well, yes. Exciting, absolutely so. And becoming more so with each passing vintage, I think. But the problem, it seems to me, is what I refer to quite simply as greed, in that some of the prices are way out of proportion to the quality of what's in the bottle.
That's not always been necessarily the case as much as it is now, is it?
No.
Avarice has taken over and
no.
has so many other industries.
When I came out here in 67, shortly thereafter, I was buying a Beaulieu Private Reserve Cabernet at $2.95 a bottle. And it must be...
You can't even get Muscatel for that now.
No, you can't. And I think the BV Private Reserve is now about $40 to $50 a bottle.
Looking at your book where you say, how could I describe the principal experience? Was it the first tasting of Warren Winiarski's 1973 Napa Cabernet Sauvignon, which captured first place in the famed 1976 Paris tasting? Was it a perfectly constructed meal by Jeremy Tower of Chez Panisse, or an equally memorable one by Charlie Trotter at his eponymous restaurant in Chicago? Those are the highlights, I guess, aren't they?
They certainly represent the highlights, and specifically they are very special highlights for me.
And you get out as much highlighting as you used to, or how does that work?
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't write the newsletters anymore, as you know, but my interest in the subject matter has certainly not decreased, and we go out a lot.
So give us like one wine and one restaurant that people should really know about that they may not know about.
One wine and one restaurant.
We'll hear from listeners about this, of course, but from Bob Finnegan.
Yes. One wine is that I like very much, that I think is underreported, is the Robert Sinsky Pinot Noir from Napa. And as far as restaurants, I think that you would have to focus on, well, any number of places. It's very difficult, but Quince is one that we've liked very much.
Quince is a jewel of a restaurant from everything I've known about it, and a good recommendation indeed. And speaking of recommendations, I'm going to go back to your book for a moment here, because you write about seeking the unusual in dining. I have a whole chapter on that. And here's a short list of advice from Robert Finnegan, which I think is useful, valuable, comes from the font of his wisdom. For the most part, stay away from the most famed places, especially in large cities where you have a better-than-average chance of being underserved and overcharged. If you're in France and using Michelin, avoid at all costs the 3 stars, and those are substantial costs. You should significant exceptions of Trois Gros and Girard. Is it Girard or Girard?
Girard.
Girard, yeah. You should focus on the 1 stars, on those rather than, or on those with 2 or 3 crossed forks, and focus intensely on what the city does best and concentrate on that, asking advice as necessary, preferably from your hotel concierge, most of whom are very well informed. For example, a good concierge in San Francisco would never send you to touristy Fisherman's Wharf for the city's famed seafood, but rather to one of the several excellent downtown restaurants. You know, and I read that and I thought to myself, I got to tell you, I mean, no, not to cast any aspersions, but I felt this even more in Europe than I have in the United States. But I'm always wondering, is the concierge in league with the restaurants that the concierge recommends? I mean, there are kickbacks that go on out there. We're all mindful of that, right?
That's right. And it really depends on the individual and, to a certain extent, the hotel. And there are restaurants that have as a fairly major part of their marketing budget kickbacks to concierge. I know that because I've been told it by reliable concierge, as a matter of fact. But in the better hotels, generally speaking, the advice that you get from a good concierge is pretty reliable.
Well, you also give advice of random conversation with locals. You can learn a lot from that, obviously.
Absolutely, you can. And that's an important source of information. And I've been interested in the way that Rachel Ray, on her wildly successful TV program on the Food Network, makes that same point. And when she's doing her any particular city on $40 a day, she asks taxi drivers and random pedestrians and on and on and on. And that's what you do.
She has become quite a phenomenon, hasn't she?
She sure has.
We're talking to Robert Finnegan. His new book is called Corks and Forks. It's all about dining and all about drinking and, well, the good life that he's led, which includes a number of really affectionate portraits, for the most part, of some of the great chefs of the Northern California area, as well as some of the great winemakers. And I've got to start you off by the story which made me laugh out loud about Julia Child. And when you were in Boston?
Oh, yes. You want to tell it or shall I tell
it? No, you tell it, of course.
Well, when I met Julia and her husband here, because Julia's sister was a good friend of Jack Shelton and was living in Sausalito, as did Shelton, and he kindly invited me to a little reception that she was having for Julia and Paul, which led to an offer on their part for me to visit them in Boston anytime I was there for dinner. And naturally, I took them up on that. And having gone to school in Cambridge, I knew the geography pretty well. And so I knew how to find their house, which was not easy. And so one evening there were, I don't know, 8 or 10 people gathered, and Julia walked into the room where we were having aperitifs with this platter with about the ugliest fish I've ever seen. And she said in that wonderful voice, "This is a cusk. What do you do with a cusk?" And we all thought, well, if she doesn't know, we don't know. And half an hour later or so, we had the most fabulous white fish that she had baked just to perfection. And so she knew what to do with a cusk.
But the story that made me laugh was, and that's a great imitation of her, by the way, was when you talked about a restaurant that you were interested in, and she spoke with some asperity about the restaurant, yeah? Now, let me see if I have the story right. You were interested in a restaurant. You want to know what her recommendation was. She said that she didn't want to go there, and she didn't want to go there because they had maligned her or said things that she didn't think.
The owner of the restaurant.
The owner of the restaurant. So having left her house and then deciding that you would try that restaurant, you went off. Next day, you talked to Julia, and she said, well, how was it?
Yeah, first thing in the morning, the phone rang about 7:30.
Even though she advised you, she had personal reasons that you would not want to go to this restaurant. She knew you were going to go.
She did.
Yeah. It's a funny story. There's, like I say, a lot of portraits in here. MFK Fisher, of Jeremiah Tower, of people who are, you know, really celebrated and quite legendary in this whole world of the culinary and wine. We have also Mondavi and Gallo portrayed. It's interesting, though, when you wrote about the French Laundry, because Thomas Keller was on this program, and I happened to have an opportunity to eat it per se in New York, and wondered about, first of all, you're describing him as whimsical, which I thought was quite interesting, but also saying, well, it's a great restaurant, but it's not the world's greatest restaurant, the French Laundry, or per se, for that matter.
Well, I think to nominate any place as the world's greatest restaurant is kind of ridiculous. It's like saying, who's the world's most beautiful woman? There are lots of them. But the French Laundry is certainly one of the very best in the U.S., I would say, but I'd put it in the same category as Charlie Trotter's in Chicago. And a few others, per se, I have not yet tried. But I think your listeners might be interested in an answer to the question of how does Keller manage the French Laundry and per se at the same time. He can't obviously be on both coasts simultaneously.
You write about it in the book. It's ingenious. They should know about this, yes.
What he did was to set up a huge flat-screen TV in the kitchen of Per Se in New York, which allows him to monitor everything that's going through the line at French Laundry. That is the cooking line. And he has a direct phone line to the kitchen there from New York. And if he sees something that doesn't please him, he's on that phone right away. I just think that's fascinating.
It's very inventive indeed. Well, you're also right. You write about Celia Chang, for example. A lot of the great chefs like Celia Chang and, well, a number of them, they're not locals. I mean, they've come here, so many of them. Not Julia Child. She was born and bred in San Francisco, but so many of them.
In Pasadena, actually.
Was she Pasadena? Because I know she went to Branson High School in Marin County. I thought she was local. She lived here for many years, didn't she?
I don't think so. No, I don't think she did. But Cecilia Chang grew up in what was then called Peking.
Yeah.
And married a Japanese diplomat and was in Shanghai after that and then in Japan and then came here from there.
And had this great success here and then went in. I learned, reading your book, became an advisor or consultant to Betelnut.
Yes.
In San Francisco. And also, talk about her. Danny Kaye was a co-chef with Cecilia Chang?
Well, Cecilia Chang had these wonderful cooking classes for a while at the Mandarin every Tuesday morning. And I religiously went because I didn't have a great deal of experience with Chinese cooking at that level. And I thought if I'm going to be writing about it, I'd better learn more than just the basics. And Danny Kaye, who was absolutely a Chinese chef of renown as an amateur, would very often fly up from Southern California for those classes. And he would even participate in the cooking a number of times and naturally break the room up with his spontaneous humor. That was really a lot of fun.
We also have a portrait of Julian Gallo with his security officers. What were they like? Dressed like highway patrolmen?
Oh, that was funny. Ernest Gallo was kind enough to invite...
I'm sorry, Ernest Gallo. I said Julius, yeah.
Me down to his home in Modesto for dinner. And when my wife and I arrived, the security officers for Gallo came up and opened her door and my door, and I noticed they were dressed exactly like CHP officers, except on the sleeve was not the CHP insignia, but a bunch of grapes and Ian J. Gallo. And I wanted to leave a camera that I'd been using earlier in the day in the car, and I asked one of these gentlemen if it would be safe to do that, and he said if anyone gets within 50 feet of your car, Mr. Finnegan, they won't get any farther.
We're talking about Finnegan again. His book is Corks and Forks, 30 Years of Wine and Food. When you get down, a little heady maybe getting invited to Ernest Gallo's home and having dinner there or getting invited to some of these great chefs' restaurants and so forth. You know, there's always a problem, I guess, in being a critic and having that maybe interfere with the critical judgment and keeping separate your feelings personally. Because a lot of these people, as I said, you seem to have real affection for.
Well, that's an excellent point, Michael. And it's very tricky because there are people, I would imagine would be true in any professional field, but there are people about whom you have to be objective, and wine and food criticism is certainly one of those fields, but we're all human beings, and there are some people that you just happen to like a lot and develop a relationship with, and you just have to be professional enough to abstract yourself from that personal relationship when evaluating the product.
It's tough. There's a story you tell in here about a restaurant you went to and you were very critical of. You said, you know, you go in as a critic, don't let them know who you are, pay cash, get out, do your review, and that's
exactly
it. You know, hit and run. But this was a particularly negative review. They didn't know who you were, the service was terrible, and food was... And then you met up with the owner. Tell that story, because it's...
Oh, that was really funny. I was entertaining a guest from out of town. And do you want me to mention the restaurant or not?
It's up to you. You mentioned the book, right?
Okay, fine. It was Julius Castle on Telegraph Hill, which is under different ownership now. But in any event, my friend said, what I really want more than anything is a wonderful piece of white veal. And let's accompany it with a Cabernet of your choice. So ordered the veal and at the same time ordered the wine. And the wine came, and it was one of the most spoiled bottles of red wine I've ever seen. It was brown and had bits of material floating in it. So I thought, all right, we'll have another one, which was also spoiled. And so I said to the waiter, why don't you bring me something that you know is good? And then the veal came, and it was actually a quite bloody beef tenderloin. And I said, I ordered white veal, at which point the owner came over, and he said, would you please leave? He said, you've ordered three bottles of wine, and you didn't like any of them, and you're telling me my chef doesn't know the difference between tenderloin of beef and veal. Just leave. And I said, would you just bring me the check for what we've had? He said, no, just leave my restaurant, please. So a couple weeks later, I was at a Christmas celebration at Perry's on Union Street. And here is this fellow, somewhat in his cups, who said, aren't you that person who came into my restaurant and turned back the wine and disparaged the veal? I said, no, I'm often mistaken for him.
Yeah. But this all came out in a review, too, that he had.
Oh, I wrote it just the way I've told it.
Yeah. And we're talking with Bob Finnegan. Incidentally, if you are interested in finding out about wine and food, he is your man. He's a San Francisco institution, and his newest book is called Corks and Forks, 30 Years of Wine and Food, which, as I said, has him described in the Chronicle as a raconteur and bon vivant. He's been at this for a couple of decades. We welcome your calls. And actually, I'd like to also invite you to call in with, well, recommendations you have one way or another. Get Bob Finnegan to comment on what you like to recommend, what you like or what you don't like in the way of restaurants or wines. But again, if you're seeking information about restaurants or wines, this is an excellent opportunity for you to find out from this bon vivant and raconteur who's spending the hour with us. Our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786, and we welcome them. You can join us now again at that number. It's 866-733-6786, and it's toll-free. Or you can email us. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. Maybe some of you may not only want to come in with some recommendations here about food or wine or questions you may have about food or wine, but also memories about what we started out talking about, which was the way restaurants used to be compared to the way they are now, or maybe the way wines used to be compared to the way they are now. Walk down a bit of memory lane here with Robert Finnegan. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Robert Finnegan, well known to Bay Area residents for Robert Finnegan's wine newsletter, which was extant between 1972 and 1990, and the author of a number of books, including the newest, Corks and Forks, 30 Years of Wine and Food. And when you get into this rarefied world that Bob Finnegan is in and have the status that he has as a wine man, let alone a restaurant guy, you get invited to take a 126-day cruise around the world to talk about wine, which you're going to be leaving on in a couple of weeks, yeah?
As my wife says, that's the real test of a marriage, to be in close quarters for 126 days. But
yeah, but what a great perquisite. I mean,
yeah, you know, it should be absolutely fascinating.
Let me read a couple of emails before we go to our calls. This comes from a listener named Felicity. Says, I'm enjoying your conversation about Julia Child and other people, wondering if you can help me locate an incredible tour de force, which Miss Child did for the National Air and Space Museum when it first opened. She was instructing people on how to make primordial soup, giving a wonderful 10-minute science lesson in the form of a cooking class. Has anyone else seen it? Is it available on the web or commercially? Also, do you remember Dion Lucas? I had the pleasure of working my way through college in her restaurant. Remember her fondly? Her omelets in particular were spectacular. I don't know if you can help us on the primordial soup, but someone out there will probably know.
I'm sure someone will. I don't happen to know.
But you know Dion Lucas.
Yes, yeah, I do by reputation. I don't believe I've ever did meet her.
Here's another listener says, as a wine enthusiast, I wonder if you've ever developed similar interests in other fine beverages such as Belgian beer or Japanese sake. I find the naturally fermented lambic ales from brewers like Cantillon to be incredibly interesting and rivals to the fine wines. What else are you going to eat with mussels anyway?
Well, that's a good point. I think that's the perfect choice for mussels, and the Belgians obviously do too. I'm not much of a beer drinker, and I just by choice don't drink spirits because I just prefer wine. So I'm not the person to ask about single malt whiskeys or things of that sort. Sake, I'm really at the first stage of a learning curve on because in this country, as we all know, the availability of really top-notch sakes has simply not been there until the past few years. So I'm working my way through some of those, and I find them extremely intriguing because of their delicacy and their differences one to another.
Let me go to our callers, and Peter, we begin with you. Good morning.
Okay, good morning. Mr. Finnegan, I was wondering if you had any idea why these heavily oaked, high alcohol, low acid wines that don't seem to go very well with food have become so popular over the last few years.
Well, I do. And I should preface my comments with saying I have great respect for Robert Parker. I know him. I like him. He works very hard. But he really prefers highly extracted, by which I mean highly flavored, high alcohol, oaky wines. I don't. And there's always a room in a critical field for a difference of opinion. But his influence with his double-digit ratings has become so great that people who really aren't very sophisticated about wine think that because something has a 96 or a 97 point rating, it must be wonderful. And my response to that always is, it's only wonderful if you really like it, not because someone else happens to like that style. Is that an answer to your question?
Well, obviously, Mr. Parker's influence is a part of it, but why? I mean, people will try these wines. Why do they continue to be popular? People don't trust their own taste?
Well, I think that's a very large part of it. I think if people who are maybe becoming acquainted with wine are told that something is superb, that will form their taste. They will associate that characteristic in the wine with excellence, and they put aside whether they really like it or don't.
Let me thank you, Peter, for the call. You know, I did an event not too long ago for some Sonoma wineries, and talk about some wonderful wines. I mean, you know, coming out of Sonoma now, everybody thinks wine up north, they think Napa, but lots happening there, lots of exciting stuff happening there.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And also, Michael, the Central Coast and Mendocino, I think, are two interesting regions, too, which are becoming more noted for their excellence than they had been in the past.
And sideways helps Santa Barbara, I guess, too, considerably.
Well, absolutely.
Patrick, join us. Morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I just wanted to say that as a San Francisco native who refuses to go to the city, I find that a lot of times there is less attention paid to some of the fantastic places right on the peninsula. For example, you have the Village Pub in Woodside, John Bentley's right next door. And it seems that there's less focus on these types of restaurants versus in the city proper or even the East Bay. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. The growth in excellence of restaurants on the particular case of the peninsula has been just astonishing to me. And certainly the Village Pub, as you mentioned, is one of those. And they just seem to be opening with increasing regularity, and I think that's a fabulous development.
And thank you, Patrick. Getting a lot of emails, you might imagine, about restaurants. This one says, please, please mention Jojo on Piedmont Avenue in Oakland. Amazing French country-style food. My favorite lamb shank melts in your mouth. You know it,
Bob? I don't know it.
Here's Gregory. He says, rise of casual fine dining, namely barbecue. Recommend Uncle Frank's barbecue on the peninsula, going back to the peninsula here. Here's a listener in San Francisco who says, Mr. Finnegan, please comment on the excessive noise levels, conversation, and general room ambience in so many otherwise fine restaurants. Some restaurant designers seem to think that this buzz adds to the dining experience, au contraire.
Oh, I'm a real bear on noise in restaurants. It's one thing to have a pleasant, lively buzz of conversation, and quite another to have your eardrums punctured with what's going on in the background. And I think Michael Bauer in the Chronicle is very wise in his reviews of ranking the sound level with the 1 to 5 incendiary bombs to indicate where the problems are. It's very important to know because it can ruin your experience no matter how good the food may be.
Michael's got a lot of clout now. I mean, he's kind of a maker and breaker of restaurants almost, isn't he?
Yes.
And here's Len in Palo Alto. Says, any comments about raw food restaurants?
Not exactly my taste, except for places that specialize in sushi and sashimi. But the sort of vegan raw food approach does not light my fire.
Makes two of us. Krista from Berkeley, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Maybe about once a month I try and go to some kind of high-end local restaurant, and I've had mixed experiences during the week. And I've heard that sometimes maybe the chef would be away, and I was wondering if there's a better night of the week to get a consistent response or consistent meal.
Well, that's a very good question, and what I always do if I'm going to a restaurant I consider important or potentially important is to call for the night that I want to reserve and make sure that the chef is there that night, because it can be a totally different experience, as you point out, if the chef isn't there.
Good question indeed. Thank you, Krista.
Thank you.
All right. By the way, if you'd like to join us, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. And Tom, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning to you.
A big fan of yours for years. I've been going to a restaurant in San Francisco for years, and since I moved there in about 78, and there's been a review that they keep in the doorway, a lot of reviews, and one of them was written by you, and it's pretty prominently placed. It says some pretty favorable things about Tommaso's on Kearney Street. My question is, have you been back there since, and do you remember it by any chance? Because I think it's weathered pretty well, and I love it. I recommend it to everybody in the family, and I've gotten to be pretty good friends, and they keep improving their wine list and so on and so forth, so.
Well, it's one of my favorites, too, and I recommend it regularly, and I'm honored that that they have my review of some years ago prominently displayed. It's truly family-owned and has been for a long time, and virtually all of the employees except in the kitchen are family members, and it's just a gem of a place, and for a true Italian trattoria, it's hard to beat.
You know, speaking about family restaurants, and we were talking before about the earlier era of restaurants in San Francisco. When I first moved out here, I used to go to these, there were a couple of these Basque restaurants. I guess maybe one or two are still surviving, but where you'd go in and you get a lot of food for a pretty reasonable rate.
Oh, yes. I enjoyed those when I first came out here, too. But
what happened to them?
I think that the owners retired or died, and a younger generation of Basques weren't interested in picking up the slack. But to be honest, I don't know of one at present.
Yeah, I thought maybe one was still existing, but perhaps you're right. We'll find out. Ross, let's go to you next. Good morning.
Hi. I have a small winery in Sebastopol called Halleck Vineyard. And, you know, we're making Pinot Noir in the midst of a passion for Pinot Noir, but we're constantly challenged by Parker and the Spectator, who are guiding the tastes of the public. I'm wondering how you would recommend a small winery like ourselves to sort of break above the noise and get some attention for some more unique styles of wine.
Well, again, an excellent question. I would write maybe to one of the columnists at The Spectator, like Jim Lobby or Matt Kramer, who would share your vision of what Pinot Noir should be like. Perhaps Linda Murphy at The Chronicle, but you have to take a rifle shot rather than a scattershot approach to contacting individual critics rather than the publications overall. I hope that helps.
And good luck to you. We thank you, Ross, for the call, and on we go to more of your calls. We go next to Menlo Park. Greg, hi.
Hi, good morning. I'm frustrated, and I'm hoping that you can help. I travel all over the United States, and I'm a steak fan. And friends of mine and I continually try to find a great steak in San Francisco to compare to other places across the United States. And routinely we try many of the local so-called steakhouses and are routinely disappointed. I'd love to hear your thoughts, and I'd take my
Let me just ask you before you go off the air, have you tried Harris's? Although I haven't been there in years, but it used to be the steakhouse, yeah?
It is, and it is the best of what's local.
What do you think, Bob Finnegan?
Well, I share the caller's frustration in being able to find a great steak in San Francisco. It just isn't a steak city. To the extent that New York would be or Chicago would be. But I like Alfred's downtown and Harris's. And to be honest, I can't think of another one that I would put in the same category as those two.
Well, I'm going to sound like a heretic here, but you know what's not bad? It's not in that category, but it's actually okay. Is Ruth Chris? I know it's a chain, and I know, you know, that turns people off and everything, but if you like a decent steak, they do an okay job.
I agree. I've been there from time to time, and that's a good assessment of it.
Let me go to more calls here, and Sean is on next. Hi, Sean.
Hi, yeah, I created a wine education company called Wine Flight, and I'm putting out a new novel tour guide of Napa for next year. So my question is, should I sell my name along with the tour guide title? Would that catch people's attention more, or is it basically just the information of what you're putting out there and your style that's really going to sell it?
Well, with some experience in the publishing field, I would say put your name on it in addition.
Create it as a brand like you did, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that helps a lot. I appreciate it. And I'd like to say Hana Sushi in Rohnert Park has some of the best sashimi in the Bay Area that I've tried.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for that, Sean. Good to hear from you this morning. And let's go to Fremont. Stu, good morning.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I'd like your guest's opinion on the pricing of wines in restaurants. I look at a price wine list, and when I know the wines and what they are retail, I think two times retail is fine. But sometimes I see three times, four times retail, and that sort of turns me off, and I'd like Mr. Finnegan's opinion on that, and I'll take this off the air.
Okay, we thank you for the call. Bob Finnegan.
I'm adamant on exactly your point. It really should be, ideally, two times wholesale, not retail, or maybe three times. But triple retail or something in that range is unconscionable. And I think, referring once again to Michael Bauer's reviews in the Sunday paper, he always gives an indication in discussing wine lists as to what the markup is, and he gives what the corkage fee is. So if the markup is really excessive and you have some nice wines of your own, which I'm sure you do, and the corkage is only $10 or $15, you'd be better off bringing your own wine to a restaurant that has exorbitant prices.
Speaking of Michael Bauer, we were talking about steaks before. He did a devastating review of Izzy's Steakhouse in San Francisco. Didn't put him out of business, but you know, it was really, really negative. And yet, there's an Izzy's over in Corte Madera that's a pretty good steak. I mean, again, the difference between one place and another place in terms of just the quality of the food could be vast, even under the same name.
Yes, exactly, it can. And I was surprised at that negative review of Izzy's because it's not that I go there really often, but I've almost never been disappointed there, and it's in my neighborhood, and I like it. But I understand that the satellite restaurants may even be better.
Do you like Two-Buck Chuck?
Two-Buck Chuck. Now, let me just make this short, but give you a little story about that. Charles Shaw, who was a very pleasant gentleman and had the objective of making California's answer to Beaujolais, lost the winery through a series of problems, and the brand was bought by Franzia in the Central Valley. And Bob Franzia believes that no wine should cost over $10. And so he brought out a Sauvignon Blanc and the red wine, and I believe a Chardonnay also, for these ridiculously low prices. And the thing about Two-Buck Chuck is, A, it's eminently drinkable. And if you're not looking for something memorable on a particular occasion. And it does vary, though, from period of the year to period of the year because Mr. Franzia uses different wines that he buys to make the blend. So sometimes it's better than other times, but it's never bad.
I had to ask because I once went to a wine tasting where all the wines were covered with silver foil and you didn't know what you were drinking and you had to rate the wines, and there were some fairly expensive and fancy wines from what I recall, and Two-Buck Chuck was in the mix and came out pretty high. In terms of rating.
I'm not surprised.
Here's a listener who says, can you tell us more about the late MFK Fisher and what she was like? How do you see her voice being missed in this day and age of fast food? And you write very memorably and warmly about her, and she was quite extraordinary. I mean, as a pro stylist, she was quite extraordinary. And as you say in your book, she was also quite lovely looking.
Lovely looking, and if you, she always was, even in her latter years. But if you look at photos of her from her years in France, or when she was a young woman, she was an absolute beauty. And she was one of those great individuals, in my opinion, who was beautiful in every way. Knowing her was one of the great highlights of my career.
Let me bring some more calls on, then we go next to Rel. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention, I've worked at El Paseo Restaurant in Mill Valley for 15 years. And
a nice restaurant.
Well known for its charm and its wonderful wine list. And
a little too heavy on the onions, but other than that.
Well, it's recently changed hands. After 36 years, it's now owned by a Japanese gentleman who owns two French restaurants in Tokyo. And the food is really, really remarkable. I mean, I don't say that because I work there. I work there because I can say that.
Huh.
I mean, it's truly, truly wonderful. And I just wanted to make...
Well, they changed the menu dramatically, or
it's it has a it's fixed menus, but but there are choices in each category. But there's like a 3-course dinner, 4-course dinner, and 5-course chef's tasting menu. But the food is truly, truly remarkable. That's all I can say. No,
well, I appreciate that, and I haven't been to El Paseo in some time, and with that tip, I will make it a point to go. Thanks again.
Thanks, Ralph, for that call. We'll go to more calls in a moment, but here's a listener who brings up an important question. As a person of moderate means in San Francisco, I have a lengthy list of restaurants I'd love to try but can only afford to eat at on special occasions. My list of affordable day-to-day restaurants in San Francisco that are really excellent is far shorter. Can you ask your guest for a recommendation of a restaurant where I can eat really great food for around $10 to $12 a plate?
Well, one that comes immediately to mind is Home. Which I like very much, and it...
Where is that, Bob?
It has 2 or 3 locations, Michael, and I think that it would fit your criteria very well, and give it a try.
Here's Bob, who tells us the only old-style Basque restaurant left is the Basque Cultural Center in South San Francisco. It's more upscale than the old Basque places, but has a daily family-style dinner as well as an a la carte menu. 5-course family-style dinner, under $20. It's a bargain. Also have decent wines under $20. And here is a listener, Joe, who recommends Laurels on Hayes Valley. Real home-cooked Cuban food, rivals my mother's, but comes a little short, of course. There's another one on 16th years ago named simply Cuba, but they're long gone. Any comments on other good Cuban restaurants in San Francisco?
Cuban food is difficult to find at a high level in this area, I think. So... That's an interesting observation. I don't have a special favorite that I can recommend, but I'll certainly try that one.
Here's Mike, who says, on a warm day last fall, I went into several large wine stores where they truly had a great selection. The problem was it was about 80 degrees. Can a temperature swing in a store turn a $40 wine into a $10 wine? How critical is temperature in the store?
It's extremely critical. And the answer to the question is yes, a $40 bottle can turn into a $10 bottle or a $5 bottle if it's badly stored. And the worst thing with wine in terms of deleterious effect is a remarkable shift in temperature. If it's 50 degrees at one point in the year and then 80 at another point, that's horrible for wine.
Here's an interesting question, a lot more philosophical, by a listener named John in Oakland. He says, is there any point beyond which paying attention to the details of what we eat and drink becomes excessive? This is not great art with a spiritual component, nor is it charity, which you talked about in the previous hour, or social good. Is it anything more than just a high-end form of consumerism and self-indulgence? What's your response to that, Robert?
Are we speaking about wine here?
Well, just talking about wine and food.
And food together.
Yeah.
I think there is a point at which the price is just out of line for that kind of experience.
Actually, I think that email is talking about something different, though. It's talking about, is it self-indulgent? Is it superfluous to talk about wine and food when there are all these weighty issues that we talk about all the time on the air? And actually... my gut response to that is, well, obviously we talk about a lot of different things, but to a lot of people, wine and food is the stuff of life. It's aesthetics. It's, you know, where it hits them most in terms of where they live. I'm not saying, I'm not putting a value on that. I'm just saying that is the case.
Well, I think that's a great way of putting it. And for some people, food is just fuel, as you know. And for other people, it's as important as... walking through a great museum. And then there are plenty of steps in between those two extremes. But for me, certainly, it's an exceptionally important part of my life.
Well, we like to talk about everything on here. And here's Jane, who has a call about Michael Bauer. Jane, huh?
Hello?
Yeah, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. There was an article in, I want to say, Focus Magazine. That's the KQED magazine, I believe.
Yes.
Some years ago, titled Eating in Michael Bauer's Town, and it's very appropriately titled because it does feel like when Michael Bauer does his make or break of a restaurant, all the other restaurants start cooking in that way. Everybody's got the same thing on the menu, and it really does feel like going out and eating at some of these high-end restaurants, it's, you know, sort of like David Sedaris saying, oh, that again. What's your thought on that?
Well, my thought is that any restaurant critic's influence is limited and has to be evaluated in terms of the circulation of the publication for which he or she writes. So what Michael says in the Chronicle, given the circulation of the Chronicle, is going to have a massive effect. But to be honest with you, I haven't seen it really affecting the cooking styles of other restaurants.
Let me thank you for the call. And here's a listener who says, is there any such thing as a good New York-style pastrami sandwich in the San Francisco area? Question I'm sure you've heard before.
I have heard before, and I wish someone would tell me where that pastrami sandwich was, because I don't know.
I don't think it's out there.
I don't think it's out there either.
And there's a listener who wants to know, talk about Michael Bauer's influence. What do you think about the charges that the Bay Area food scene has been limited by the Alice Walker effect? Alice Waters effect. Alice Waters once joked about how people call her Alice Walker, and vice versa. Alice Waters effect, that's the first time I've heard that phrase, but I think we know what this listener is talking about.
Well, I think that the positive effect of what Alice has been championing is fresh seasonal ingredients as locally sourced as possible. But I think what people tend to do is to give her too much credit for that, because women in all parts of the world have been cooking that way for millennia. And fresh foods, great ingredients, local sourcing is not a new concept.
Well, it's always a pleasure to see you, Bob Finnegan, and I just want to remind listeners, his book, 30 Years of Wine and Food, is called Corks and Forks. Pleasure having you with us this hour.
Pleasure to be here, Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to thank you for your listenership and tell you that we're produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.